just go ahead and begin the public hearing on the House Bill 5035, Public Employees Retirement System. If you want to come on up and start this morning, welcome. Good Tuesday morning, whatever.
Thank you. Chair Carno, I'm Jim Boyko again for the record, Director of PERS. I'm accompanied by Gail Orr, our Chief Financial Officer, and
Sarah Gates.
Yeah. Okay.
Would you like us to begin on page 27? I think we left off 26 yesterday.
Yes, go ahead and begin there.
We're at page 27 of the March 12th Governor's Recommended Budget Overview. We had just completed a discussion of our technology shortcomings and why we have some spending initiatives in place there. On page 27, we're talking about the growth in the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. We have about 45% of state workers now who have signed up for this plan in addition to PERS, and I talked a little bit about what that said about the savings impetus in public employees, at least at the state level. There are some stats on page 27 that indicate the likely growth we expect in this program. Give you a little background, we have only one person who's exclusively devoted to this program. And in fact, we get reimbursed for that expense from our third-party administrator, but we still need spending authority to allow us to spend the money before we then turn around and get reimbursed. The remainder of the work is done by the third-party administrator under a long-term contract, as well as some partial responsibilities that are spread over a number of employees. Description of those was actually given to Mr. Wyan this morning. On page 28, this is a topic that is of some concern to us for a whole variety of reasons. It turns out also to be a budget concern. I think we all have heard the phrase, we live in a more litigious society. Well, PERS is feeling that as well. We have a number of things underway, all of which are working to increase our attorney general fees. One is the degree of system-wide litigation, and we have a number of suits underway, both from employers and employees. We also have made a commitment to our stakeholders to codify better our rules and practices, and this is a major effort underway at the agency, all of which, of course, requires some work with DOJ before we begin a rulemaking process. And this has been received, by the way, very well by our stakeholders. Because there were a number of practices that were conducted at the agency, not that they were good or bad, but they were not well codified and easily accessible by our stakeholders. And the last is a substantial increase in the number of decisions by the agency and the board that are being appealed through the available appeals process, and indeed some of them are also going all the way on to litigation after they've exhausted their appeals. All three of these things have led to a substantial increase in our use of the Attorney General's office. We've gotten excellent support from them, I might say, and we have a very good business arrangement with them. We understand their fees and their billings, but the bottom line is that with appeals volumes, for example, rising 14 times over the previous biennium, it's turned into a significant budget issue for us.
Butler.
I'm sure it always concerns me when I see increases in AG fees and a doubling of Attorney General's fees in this particular case. I appreciate the fact that we live in a more litigious society, and I don't like to pay lawyers' bills any more than the next guy, I suppose. But the concern that I have is that we need to streamline or do something within the system that lends itself to these kinds of lawsuits and then the volumes of appeals. I'm wondering if we might be able to get a breakdown of the nature of the packaging or of the litigation that is involved.
Well, we list PERS litigation and related costs, and they say here in their response that they haven't had time to.
All right, I hadn't seen that, so that's forthcoming. Thank you.
Excellent. You need that information.
Yes, and Sarah, if we could have that somewhat detailed as to the nature, and then just one other breakout in that, if it was at all possible, the nature of the source of the claim. Are these state employees from X department? Are these? I know that our currently our judges. We expend a lot of money in that section, relative to our judges, and that'll be a question that we can ask at a little bit later time. But I'd like to come back to that and have it broken down as to which is it a particular group or particular groups that are demanding or requiring us to incur additional legal fees, and then. And the reason I'm asking that is that, Madam Chair, maybe before we're done here, the concept of the no administration costs or the plus administration costs for various groups needs to be examined. Again, I know that there are some groups that are absolutely extremely demanding for information. When I say extremely demanding, it's very complex. And they incur that expense. That expense is incurred by the public employee retirement system on behalf of that particular group, but it is shared by everyone disproportionately in relationship to what they're actually receiving. So I think if we could zero in on the nature of some of these increases, it might give us a little bit better feel as to where we needed to look when we talk about additional or no-cost administration, in effect, when we talk about that issue. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I think that's troubling us all as we begin to look at these budgets, especially if we're sitting on more than one budget panel, to realize the different assessments, greater than some than others. Representative Hayden?
Well, along that line, the first board would have only limited control over the amount of suits, other than doing a very good job, so nobody ever sued. You know, they would have limited control over the number of suits that they get. But as with a number of other agencies that we've talked to, is there a way to direct some of these legal suits into grievance procedures or arbitration or mediation, which would be less expensive in terms of attorney general costs? And I don't know.
And we have an excellent community dispute resolution program, i.e. mediation within government. Are we utilizing it, or are we just suing?
Yeah, Dallas has a hand up.
Okay. Now, Chair, members of the committee, with respect to AG's fees, I know that the Attorney General is working with the Department of Administrative Service in setting up guidelines for agencies and how to minimize or avoid costs, unnecessary costs or duplicative costs. And I guess we would encourage the public employees retirement system to, they're on the distribution list for that stuff and that. So there is a statewide effort, if you will, being formulated to address this. Gatekeepers, you know, in agencies is one way to keep people from picking up the phone and hollering. And also, you know, another option might be when the attorney calls to hang up. But seriously, they are developing an approach to this, hopefully to help minimize the cost.
Madam Chair, the other concern that jumps out at me is that we move to a doubling of the volume of appeals, and always the question is with regard to taking these to the last level of Court of Appeals is, are we prevailing in those instances? If we're not prevailing, and of course, what does it mean to prevail anymore? If you've got 20 different causes of action in each one, and to prevail on one, we heard from another department that they were prevailing in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so they prevailed on every suit, and so it would be nice to know the nature of the appeals as well, and the result of ongoing and settled appeals. And I think Representative Hayden is exactly right. That is, you know, how much of this can we accomplish also within the dispute resolution process?
Chair Quarno, could I offer some clarifying comments? Because this is an excellent discussion. It's obviously one that's troubling us as well. With respect to the, there were three things I mentioned, the major pieces of litigation, the appeals to the Board of Agency Decisions, and our rulemaking. And the major pieces of litigation, I don't believe, and this is an opinion on my part, that the parties are interested in dispute resolution. They want the judicial system to rule on very fundamental aspects of the PERS statute. And they have proceeded along those lines pretty single-mindedly. And in fact, we now have many parties revolving around that major suit and several satellite suits. With respect to the appeals and litigation that often follows, there are two types, disabilities claims and also claims of money that was put in reserve for the system as a whole that some individuals feel advantaged or disadvantaged them. In our statute, we have a series of requirements that we have to follow with respect to hearing those appeals. And because some of those can involve precedent, we almost always involve the DOJ to make sure that we don't set precedents that then harm the system as a whole for the long run. In the area of rulemaking and pre-rulemaking, what we tried to do is to avoid as much legal expense as we can, is we have a lot of pre-meetings with our stakeholders before we initiate a rulemaking. I think I talked about those yesterday. But even so, they want to hear themselves from DOJ at those pre-meetings about whether or not we're authorized to have a rule and what the issues are. In fact, the presence of DOJ is often insisted upon by our stakeholders, which then, of course, we have to shoulder the expense. The two things I would mention, three things, is that we are looking at dispute resolution to see if that can be fit into the processes that we're required to follow. We already have joined with other agencies to use a centralized administrative law judge approach, which has worked very well for us. And the third is you'll be hearing from us about our proposal to create a small risk management section. The substitution of the people that we would have here for DOJ attorneys would offer us savings in terms of handling lots of the more mundane aspects of these legal questions before they get to the point where we really need to have an attorney present. And so part of our thinking here is that one of the responsibilities of this risk management group, this handful of people, would be to handle all of the lower level and pre-litigation work so that we wouldn't have to have a higher priced attorney brought in from DOJ. That's our hope anyway. I hope that was helpful. Chair Carno, page 29, if I might proceed, that brings us a nice segue into this question of risk management and probably the area of the agency that I feel most concerned about from the point of view of the depth of our staffing. We've worked with DAS-BAM over the last year. In fact, I think the first real conversation we had about it was last May at our board retreat when we discussed this with our board. We've looked at other similarly sized pension systems and smaller ones across the country, and we have by far the fewest internal resources for internal audit. Internal audit is a resource that you can call on from a management point of view and direct to trouble spots exactly when and where you need them. And this is not to say that the audit division isn't helpful, because the audit division has expertise in this work, but comes when they want to come, when they want to look at something. There's a big difference. Also, an audit from the audit division is much more expensive than sending in somebody on your management team who's skilled at auditing issues and risk management issues directly to a point well before you think it has become a problem area. Right now we have one person, and so the opportunities are limited. I mentioned yesterday that I think I said that we have 28 areas on our risk management list that haven't been audited in 10 years. That doesn't make me comfortable. Also, audit capabilities are changing. Auditors no longer can just be skilled in finance. They also have to have some skill in systems, because almost all financial data that needs to be audited is resident, and certainly at PERS, on systems. And so how the system handles and accounts for that data is as important almost as what the numbers are themselves. In addition, this staff would allow us to do things like do preparatory work on legal suits, or on appeals in hopes of trying to make sure that they don't become litigation later on down the road. You asked a question earlier about whether or not we prevail, and I think the answer is we almost always prevail in these cases, which I think is testimony, I hope, to good work by our staff. Or maybe we're not pushing hard enough, I don't know, which is like skiing. If you don't fall a couple times, maybe you're not where you need to be. But the bottom line is that we think that this handful of people can serve many purposes at the agency that are currently not met by anyone in particular. Litigation, for example, is handled by line managers. The lawyers work directly with line managers. We hand out pieces of litigation or appeals to individuals in addition to their line management duties. And so I would say that if I was our attorney at DOJ, I would say we're not the best of clients. On page 30, board policy initiatives, we have actually quite a few. This is just a sampling. Pooling is one that's very important. You have heard a lot about it, and in fact, you have a legislative concept before the substantive committee here at the legislature. The board put a final rule in place and is reporting on that rule to the substantive committees in case the committees would like us to go in a different direction. We are currently engaged in a substantial amount of employer outreach and have been for the last year on the question of pooling. We have also have a legislative concept codifying what the board has already done by rule and employer participation and variable, which I think is a critical issue in terms of making money match actually work. We conducted, the board and the staff put in place an actuarial audit over the last year to audit the work of our longtime actuary. The audit came up basically a green light, but listed a laundry list of things that we ought to look into further. We selected a substantial piece of those, probably 6 or 8 items, each of which requires individual study in its own right. We have no true actuarial resources on staff. We outsource all of that, and currently we've maxed out the capabilities of our actuarial external resources as well because of the work that we need to do with employers on pooling. And we also think that the staff needs to be not so exclusively dependent for what is at the heart of the matter, its most important responsibility, actuarial analysis on external parties. So again, this risk management group, we would hope, would also have some capability of looking into this laundry list of issues. We're doing some major work on the simulation of the money match, which has become over the past several years the driving methodology for the actuarial foundations of the public employees retirement system. We have a lot of work left to do. It has taken us almost a full year working with just a handful of people to put this into place. We think this offers an opportunity for a major step forward in terms of new tools for the board to understand how much or how little money should be placed into reserves and defending the system against suits that there's too much or too little. But, you know, we're...
Representative Butler.
Thank you. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr.
Oh,
Boyce.
Quite all right.
Looking over your FTE chart on page 6, I thought I remembered that we had some specialists in there that could assist us with actuarial matters. There's no actuaries or trained actuaries on staff at all.
We have none whatsoever.
Would that be typical in an operation this size?
Not at all, sir.
In doing a tour of your facility 2 years ago, I thought I remembered that there were some very, very specialized people, but also that we met the outside actuaries. I can certainly understand why outside actuaries would be necessary to make sure that they attest to the viability and the integrity of the system as a whole. Internally, we don't have anyone that has any actuarial training, or?
Let me, Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, let me clarify. We have financial analysts on board, and it is not uncommon. In fact, it's the norm for a board such as ours or an agency such as ours to have external professional auditing firms do actuarial work. I think it is unusual not to have anyone who's specifically trained or certified as an audit, as an actuary on board, or at least have some direct training in actuarial science. And I'm going to turn to my CFO, who those people would work in his division. Do we have anybody that actually has professional certification at any level in actuarial science? We have none whatsoever, Representative Butler.
Thank you.
Just to finish up quickly on page 30 with a few more examples, the board has also asked us to do a white paper on benefit policies nationally. The board, in its own policy and goal statement, has clearly stated that this is an area that is under the purview of the legislature, not the PERS board or the agency. But in anticipation that from time to time the legislature may ask us questions about the state of affairs on this issue nationally, we've been directed to do such a white paper. At the present time, we have a person working on it, and it happens to be our press officer, because that's the person that's freed up. Again, this is another type of responsibility that we might have this risk management and research group look at. The last one is performance measures and management information system measures. We do have a set of performance measures. I'm not happy with them in terms of the picture that it gives the senior management of the activities of the agency in real time. When there is time, when we get out from underneath some of the controversies and other more pressing issues, I would very much like to go back and retrofit the entire agency with a better set of performance measures that are produced on a more timely basis. But right now, that has to take a backseat to some of the other work that that is much more time sensitive. On page 31, we talked a little bit about some of these issues, so I'll go through them fairly quickly. What is our plan for dealing with them? Well, with respect to the workload that I talked about yesterday, the likely dramatic increase in total membership over the next 5 to 15 years, we have a very ambitious plan to do two things. One is to improve our technology base to empower people with much more powerful and more flexible tools than we have today. And part two of that, it's not just replacing the computer system, so to speak, but it's also then looking at all of the work processes that we have now that have been defined by the limitations of our technology. I mentioned the example yesterday of having to have two people sit side by side in front of a screen to make sure one isn't doing something bad. That's not the way life ought to be, but it is a work process that has been that required in essence by the limitations of our technology. And what we and it would be a shame to actually replace the information technology system and then not go back and say, well, let's look at all these work processes that we've contorted to have to cope with our old system and streamline them in a way that allows us to take full use of the new tools. So we're actually spending a good bit of the spending that we're doing in this OPUS program is not just on the computers and the software, but actually on going back through and trying to make sure that people are conducting their work day to day in a way that makes maximum use of the tools that we're investing in. The other thing I would say about OPUS is that, remember I said before yesterday that one of our biggest workload issues is sometimes having to go back and do things twice, either because of changes in policy or because of errors that we made. Some of the errors we make is because a number of our processes, estimates range as high as 35% of our work, of our transactions, involve some manual process that has to be done in addition to the mainframe process. That's an invitation to error. And every time that we find one of those, we have to go back and redo it. That cuts productivity in half every time we do it. I'm not happy with that, but it really reflects, again, the limitations that RIMS places on us now. And I think that there'll be a substantial improvement, both in terms of stakeholder trust in the agency's work, as well as in our own productivity, if we can do what's called in the transaction business one and done. Page 32, we mentioned the Oregon Growth Savings Plan and the challenges that it has had. What we've done there is we have reconfigured the part of the process, or the part of the program that we put the most manpower against, which is the pieces of the counselors that go to advising the growing number of members about how the Oregon Savings Growth Plan works. We don't try to do financial planning for them. That's not what we're involved in. What we want to do is make sure they understand the rules and processes of the Oregon Savings Growth Plan and the nature of the options that they are faced with making, because they do make their own investment choices in this program. What we've done, when we started this program, we had people that were qualified to counsel in the traditional PERS retirement program and those that were capable of looking at the new OSGP program, and the structures and the choices that individuals have to make are dramatically different. And what we've done is we've said this is poor productivity and poor use of individuals, and we have insisted that they get cross-trained in both programs so that they could we could send one person to one meeting to satisfy both needs at the same time. And in our budget, you'll see that what we're asking for is a reclass for those people who have successfully cross-trained and are able to deliver what previously we often asked two people to do. We're also, on the savings side, we have been very aggressive in this past year in renegotiating with the third-party administrator, as well as cutting our own fees that we charge this program to stand on its own two legs. And those fees have already dropped by 40%. And we anticipate that as the program grows and we get greater economies of scale, those fees can only go further down unless the legislature were to direct us to raise service levels. Page 33.
Ms. Johnson?
I guess for me that's sort of the crux of the whole debate. I've had a lot of trouble following the presentation that you've been doing, and it raises a lot of questions, and part of that's because I'm completely new to this. But you just said that you're going to continue to raise programs and look for grow programs and look for economies of scale unless the legislature directs you to do something about charges for those programs. And I guess for me that's one of the core issues that we're getting at. How many more services will you add at what cost? It's like selling below cost and making it up in volume. Is there something I'm not getting that you can help me understand?
Chair Clarno, Representative Johnson, let me try. First of all, we're not looking for new programs. I mean, if the legislature wants us to do more programs, I'm sure you won't be shy about telling us. But we have this program, and it grows because people sign up for it. And that's really how it's grown. Either individual employers sign up and say, I want to offer it to my employees, or employees sign up, and it's been very successful, and that's why it's growing. The real question is, what's the right level of service to provide these people? We have a level of service that is largely based on group counseling, some individual counseling, and web and paper communication. We're not going to change, either raise or lower that, or at least that's not our plan, the general level of service we provide in the program. The program will grow, we'll keep the service levels roughly the same, and try to find ways like cross-training to deliver it more cost-effectively.
How can the program stay the same, though, when you have more people coming in and they have the expectation that counseling and publications and communication will be available for them, and you're not going to change your service level?
Representative Johnson, that's exactly the heart of the difficulty. We don't want to change the level that we offer, but as volumes increase, we do face pressure to produce more of the same units, but we're not adding new levels of service. So we're not, for example, saying we are now going to entitle every OSGP member to an individual counseling session every 3 months. We have no intention of doing that. We're going to keep making the same service offer, and if the demands grow on us, it will only be because of organic program growth. I don't know. I hope that was responsive. Yes, the demands will grow, but not because we're raising the nature of the services, only because the number of people in the program asking for the same level of service we hold out grows.
Unless I'm missing something, the more people come in, you're not changing your response, somebody's going to get less service.
And in fact, Representative Johnson, Chair Clarno, that's pretty much what's happening, because in these productivity initiatives that we have been steering people away at every point from individual service into group counseling sessions. They get the same information, but they get it in a way that's more productive or more cost efficient for us to deliver. We haven't stopped individual counseling and said there'll be no such thing. But we have made every effort to try to get people to be more interested in the group sessions. So you could say that as we do those things in response to rising volumes, the service level has declined a little bit. We don't think so in the quality of information, but perhaps in the accessibility of it and the personalization of it, it has declined somewhat.
Madam Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kind of following in line with the question that Representative Johnson was pursuing, and I asked this question, I think, 2 years ago, and I'm now more dissatisfied than I was then with the answer I received then. And that is, when I asked about the Oregon Savings Growth Plan and why it was that the state of Oregon created its own deferred compensation program as opposed to going to the outside, because there are many wonderful and good for-profit outside deferred compensation companies, I was told that this was a method of keeping our program in one piece, and that somehow this was directed that we should do it all in-house. Now, my understanding is that we're spinning our wheels and putting a lot more energy and time into the Oregon Savings Growth Plan when we could be contracting this work with the outside, and in effect letting employees have a choice as to where they wanted to move that plan, as opposed to having no choice once they are a state of Oregon employee.
Well, Chair Clarner, Representative Butler, I'm being only on the job for 11 months. I don't know the history of the program, but I will say this. The program is largely as you describe it, in the sense that all of the investment work, all of the record keeping work, much of the information production, all of the data communications are in fact outsourced to the private sector. And the number of the issue that we're discussing here is largely revolves around a handful of counselors, some of whose time, because of cross training now, is devoted to answering questions and giving discussions. So we certainly not want to leave you with the impression that we have some large staff devoted to this program. We have a small number of people devoted part-time, and we have one person devoted full-time who we're asking spending authority for, but whom the third-party administrator actually reimburses us for. Because we were unhappy with their provision of the individual, we said we'd prefer to have our own, but you need to pay, and they agreed with that. And it's actually been a good mutual it's been a good mutual trade. So,
Madam Chair, I'd like to just call a little bit of a time out then with regard to the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, and just ask why it is that we just don't do the whole thing on the outside. So we don't do any of the counseling, we don't do any of the administration. The funds just go straight out to a third party, and then the people, the employees who choose to go to the deferred compensation or other types of outside parties can move to that outside provider or those outside providers, and all of the communications, virtually after a check is written on a monthly basis or every two-week basis or whatever it is that the state is involved in here, I'd like to know why we just don't divest ourselves of the whole thing and totally get out of it, not having full-time counselors, part-time counselors, reimbursed counselors from an outside agency, just get the state out of the deferred compensation business, because I receive, I'm involved in other deferred compensation plans, and I receive those plan statements, and it doesn't involve the state of Oregon at all, and I'd like to see us get out of it.
Chair Kleiner, Representative Butler, the program certainly could be run that way because many deferred compensation programs are. The only issue that I would put on the table is that State Street or any other third-party administrator is unlikely to be able or willing at the current contract price level to deliver the service that we are currently delivering with our counselors who are already talking to public employees, so they're there in front of them anyway, the same level of service. So I would predict that at the same prices, we would have our members in OSGP, who are by definition also members in PERS, they would get a lower level of service. This is for the legislature to decide whether that's good or bad, but I think it would be very likely to be a decline in the service that they get. If you were to ask State Street, I'm sure that they would say, you know, we couldn't put people in front of OSGP members to give the same information that the PERS staff can, because we don't have people out here in the state of Oregon in those numbers in proximity all the time to PERS members as PERS itself does. So if you believe that that's a good level of service, I think it'd be hard for any third-party vendor, however efficient, to make up for the efficiencies that PERS staff presents simply by being on the premises and next to the PERS members on a continuing basis.
And Chair, I guess I would come back and assert where I'm starting from in this whole chasing my tail around on this particular issue, and that is that I don't, as a result of the fact that I may participate in a program that was afforded me when I worked as a city sewer main cleaner outer, or as I worked as a custodian in a county building somewhere, or as I later work as a county commissioner, or as I later do any kind of work, those programs that are afforded me, what you're telling me, Mr. Boyko, is that if I don't have a state employee or a state-sponsored employee through the PERS to explain how those programs dovetail with my PERS, that I just am not going to know, and I'm not going to be able to get it figured out, and I'm not going to enjoy the level of retirement satisfaction and benefits that I would if I had a PERS employee explaining how these programs dovetail. And I'm sorry, the NACO program or the League of Oregon Cities program, the League of Cities program, does not provide a counselor that comes and tells me. However, they have every capability of taking your annual statement and saying, it says you're going to get $300 a month or $800 a month, and by golly, we can dovetail that with your plans. And they'll come out and they'll consult with me over the telephone, and they'll do so by mail. At no cost to the state, no cost to the balance of the employees under the PERS system. So now my question is, what level of mandate do we have here that the state has to be in the Oregon OSGP, the Oregon State Growth Plan? Is it a mandated service, or is this something we've voluntarily taken on?
It's not a mandated service, and in fact, Representative Butler, we have relatively few statutorily required services, customer service, mandates in the statute. There are a few that relate to getting checks and retirement transactions done in a specific period of time. But otherwise, most of what we do, we gauge off industry practice. And there are, we can look, in fact, I would call your attention to page 46 in the presentation, because this is a good time, I think, to look at it, because it enlightens this debate, or it's not a debate, it's a discussion. This is something that's done by the best third-party benchmarking organization looking at public pension plans. And what they do is they assess how complex your plan is, how big it is, and a variety of attributes that affect the cost of delivering services. And then they do a predicted cost. They look at the services that you clearly provide, and the line says where you ought to be. Oregon's dot below, where it says OPERS, Oregon Public Employees Retirement System, is where they benchmark us now, which means that we're producing what we say we do at a lower cost than they would have projected. But as you notice, there are people that are above the line. As we talk to this third-party organization in terms of benchmarking, what they tell us is the people that are above the line are sometimes there because they're not particularly efficient, but they're sometimes there because they provide extraordinary levels of service. And again, as you point out, this is a question of what's the right level of service. I would predict that if you pick the level of service that we're delivering today, it's most efficient because the PERS people are already there in front of these members to do it that way and to drive a harder bargain with the third-party administrator. However, if you picked a much lower level of service, it might very well be more efficient to simply say, call State Street on the telephone, and that's the only service that you're going to get.
I'm still perplexed. We're basically, what we're doing is, as Representative Johnson kind of alluded to, we're making up on volume. And I'm wondering if, I was dissatisfied when I heard the response to my inquiry 2 years ago as to why I had to be and could only be with the Oregon Savings Growth Plan as a state employee, did not have my choice of continuing a deferred compensation with any outside provider. And basically, I'm wondering now if we're not basically subsidizing a portion of the Oregon Savings Growth Plan with PERS benefits, or the overhead and the PERS, or vice versa. And the bottom line is, if it's a profit center, do we know that? And do we know, do we have actual costs and overheads, and you can allocate those and give those to us?
Chair Clarino, Representative Butler, I'd make two offers. One is that if this is something that you'd like to explore in more depth, I'd be happy to meet with you. And we could, in fact, show you that we are keeping the two programs financially separate, even though sometimes we use cross-trained people
mm-hmm.
to do both services. We could show you some of the things that State Street does as the third-party administrator and those things that we do, so you can get a sense of how much PERS staff is really doing versus how much the third-party administrator is doing. And we can give you some examples of similar programs run in other states so you can get a sense of context. I'd be more than happy to meet with you, we'll bring the staff with me and give you that total picture.
Madam Chair, at the risk of prolonging this, the comment Mr. Boyko is making, as I hear, is that how much per staff is involved in assisting with this, and I basically, that is my point, that per staff are in fact being used to advance, promote, sell, maintain the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, and that's where we should not be using any of the resources from the PERS at all. Now,
no, we charge, excuse me, Representative Butler, but we do charge this plan for that time. There's no cross subsidy. I mean, we assess a charge to Oregon Savings Growth Plan assets to make sure that the PERS trust fund is not cross subsidizing.
Okay. So that isn't, I mean, we don't have bait for a lawsuit here then.
No, I think we have a legitimate discussion over what's the level of service and who ought to provide it. I think that's what we have.
And I appreciate that, and my concern, it still comes back, and I see Steve has his ORS open up back there, so he'll be able to give me the answer very shortly. But I still would like to have an opportunity to see, and this represents, let's make no bones about it, this represents a rather substantial asset to the PERS system. This is a book of business that basically has a value to it of a whole group of how many customers? We get
about 45% of all state employees and a growing number of local employees. So it's
so 20,000+.
But we're not selling, you know, we're servicing. You know, it's take it or leave it. We'll explain all your questions. We'll come and visit your city council and say what the plan does and doesn't. But if you don't want it, we're not trying to grow it.
But what I'm saying is you're not giving the employees an opportunity to select on the outside either.
Chair Klein, Representative Butler, that's not quite true. They could enter into annuities on the outside. They don't. This is a voluntary plan. They don't have.
I appreciate it's voluntary, but there's for withholding purposes right now at the state of Oregon. There's only one place that a plan of this nature can be invested, and that's in the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. The myriad of private companies that are out there that provide this service are not available to a state employee.
Chair Clarino, Representative Butler, that is true in the sense of the people who assemble a package of investments and deliver it, although all of the investments inside the Oregon Growth Savings Plan are all private sector, and in fact they represent an extraordinarily wide array of private sector providers.
I would anticipate that would be the case. I would be disappointed if they were just investing in mortgages of state employees or directors of departments or something like that. But I guess where I'm coming from, Mr. Boyko, is that I would like to have, number one, the statutory information, number two, an actual breakdown of what we're doing here, so that we can see to what extent we are asking for the state to participate through the possibility of certainly we're, you tell me that we're doing a fee-for-service out of PERS for those folks who choose to go ahead on their flex plan and have the deferred compensation benefit. Now, that's all it's involved here, isn't it? Is just the deferred comp, or is there more in the
Oregon Savings Growth Plan? I believe it's only deferred compensation. Okay. There is no other menu of benefits. I might say, and this is a bit of an editorial comment, that I've been involved in the private sector for private companies in putting together plans of this nature, and I would be delighted to come in and present to you on just this issue, because I think this is an exceptionally good plan. That's an opinion on my part. But I think it has a lot going for it, and I'll be happy to explain all of the reasons why.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wojcik, I would expect you to tell me that it was the best that money could buy. If you told me that you were doing a lousy job and that any Tom, Dick, or Harry on the street could do better,
becoming you're trying to change it.
Then I'd be surprised if you didn't have a bill out there to maybe modify the way we're doing this. So, and I appreciate your level of confidence and assurance. But I still come back to the fact that private industry has an ability many times to come in and offer these kinds of things, and they're all street investments one way or the other. And there is an overhead to the plan, but normally when we see these deferred compensations are packaged up and you're buying at street value or a discount from that, and the fact that we may be doing better, but it's costing the overall system. We need a bigger computer. We need a bigger whatever in order to manage this. I look at that and say, this might be the time to say, let's go ahead and package this bundle of business up that's in the Oregon Growth Savings Plan, Oregon Savings Growth Plan. Let's package this up and offer it for sale to the whomever, whatever you name your own deferred compensation company that has a plan, because there are many, and then allow that to happen to be integrated, if you will, with the employee's annual statement.
I'd like to walk you through the recent RFP we just put out, because we just re-upped the contract.
Mm-hmm.
We just put out the contract again, and indeed you are absolutely correct. We had a number of very highly qualified responders, not just the one that we picked in the end, but we had a number of deferred compensation package providers in terms of the third-party services that we were asking for. And we happened to pick the one, obviously, that we thought offered the best set of services for the price. And so I'd be happy to walk you through the responses that we got.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And then I also appreciate the fact that we may have the situation here where there's some economies of scale. When we're serving the same people on one side and we're serving the same people on another side, we might have a health program that they're participating in and have all of these various issues out there that it might just absolutely be mandatory that there's nobody that could do it cheaper. But I would certainly like an opportunity to at least look at this at this point.
Done.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Let's see. I think we'll go ahead and take a break. It's 9:30, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes.
Take a break. He's going to break my arms.
Okay.